Brad, it's been out for a couple of weeks now. Have you been watching the Mandalorian over on the new Disney Plus mega channel there, mega streaming thing?
Oh my gosh. Yes, we jumped in right away when Disney Plus came out. We went with the tens of thousands others and signed up. And I've been loving it. And actually, it's kind of neat because I think everybody in the family has their own reason for loving it. I've been watching all the old Muppet movies, but as a family, we've been diving right into The Mandalorian.
Yeah, I there is a lot to like about the way they are approaching that. But okay, I'm gonna put a little spoiler alert on here. If you spoiler alert, a word is
a spoiler.
Good morning,
alert.
Dave Kelly. So spoiler: if you haven't listened to this, fast forward 2 or 3 minutes real quick, because I want to share what I was thinking, Brad. So at the end of the first episode of The Mandalorian, we discovered there's a baby Yoda, right? A little baby species. It's not Yoda, obviously. It's a baby Yoda, so here's my thought. I wanted to pitch this to you as what could have happened, how we could have gotten here story-wise. So now, we know that the species is not named in Star Wars, right? You know it's always been called Yoda's species. And the only other one we've seen, at least as far as I'm aware, is there was a female member of the Jedi Council in The Phantom Menace, and her name was Yaddle, right?
Yes, I remember Yaddle.
So, here is my question to you, Brad. How lonely were the knights on the Jedi Council? Was everybody's lightsaber still working at 800 years old? That's what I want to know, because here we're suddenly presented with a beautiful 50-year-old baby Yoda. Now, that just seems like, maybe there's some scandal on the Jedi Council there? What are the rules, Brad, for the Jedi Council members getting to know one another?
Oh,
I'm
my
not
gosh.
Sure.
That's fascinating. I can just hear it now. Come here often,
right? No,
do
we don't need that. No, stop, stop, stop. I'm going to stop you right there. I'm going to stop you right there. We don't need a reenactment.
You misinterpreted my It was Yoda pickup lines. Come here often, do you?
See if your father is. Someone has stole the stars and put them in your eye. They have.
Oh my God.
Although you can pretty much just sum it up at.
That's a Yoda pickup line. Hello, Master Yoda. No, Master Yoda, sorry. I'm happily married. No.
Yes. Oh God. Yeah, that's a good question. The mating habits of the Yoda species.
Yeah, well, I really am enjoying from a storytelling perspective that the baby is 50 years old, and there's a reason why they lived to 809 years old. Because it's like those sea turtles that live to be 200 or whatever, or those sharks that are conceivably 300, 400 years old. It's fun to just imagine their adolescence stretching that long.
A 20-year adolescence. I barely made it through the 3 or 4 that I had.
Oh, God.
20 years of adolescence. Could you imagine the torture that would be?
Brad, 30 to 40 years of zits. That's what you've got looking forward to. As a member of Yoda's species, 30 to 40 years of zits.
Yeah, and then 30 to 40 years of inappropriate lightsabers. There's all kinds of things that can go wrong with a 30-year puberty. But before we go into totally inappropriate areas, can we talk about, seriously, in a comic lab way, the power of good character design? That character, and when you look at that, and then just recently they re-released the character designs for Sonic the Hedgehog, because the first character designs for that, for the upcoming CGI movie, were just god-awful. It really shows you the power of dropping back to those tried-and-true techniques of character design that just never fail. Those eyes, the ears, the texture, that baby Yoda is a symphony of good character design.
Oh, it's great. And you know, Brad, we've seen over the course of Star Wars, speaking of Yoda, about 5 or 6 iterations of his design.
Yeah.
And there have been some terrible ones. The one from Phantom Menace is not good. Like, you watch that and you're like, duh, creepy.
Right.
And then they kind of course corrected back in the next 2 prequels towards a better Yoda with the bouncy ears and stuff. But this one is the perfect mix of CGI and live action props. And puppeteering. And it's it's all the standards that make you want to take care of a human child, which we are all biologically geared to do when we see short, stunted limbs, large head, large eyes, cute gaga voice, right? All of that we're biologically triggered to take care of a small creature, which is why we respond to puppies, which is why we respond to kittens, which is why we, you know, it triggers that same base biological response in us. And so when you're designing a character that needs to be sympathetic, there's a reason why my sympathetic characters in Drive all have big, gigantic eyes, and the evil ones have a very different eye set. And so, the design of Yoda, the baby Yoda in this thing, whatever his name might end up being, is brilliant because it's not only a good iteration of Yoda, it's a really good iteration of everything that they can use as storytellers to trigger your sympathy and your empathy for this character. And it's great. Yeah. It's really good.
And they did it without turning him into an Ewok, which is that same thing, but turned up to a saccharine level that it ends up kind of pushing us away. Like, think about it. Baby Yoda could have very easily gone the way of an Ewok, but they didn't. They kept it. They really put a lot of thought and time into it.
Listen, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's one of my favorite designs from the Star Wars universe. It's so well done. It's such a good iteration of what a child from that species would look like. Even the fuzzy baby-like hair, for anyone who's ever taken care of a baby, that unnecessary hair that's kind of everywhere on a baby, a human baby, that creates kind of a peach fuzz. And it's got
that kind of kiwi texture.
Kiwi is exactly. Yeah, he's basically a living kiwi. The overbundled blankets in a lot of scenes that they use to really reinforce cuddliness and warmth and sweetness. As a design, it's just great. It's really great. It's really, really great. Anyway, that's been Brad and Dave being fanboys about the new Baby Yoda. Thanks for tuning in this week. We'll see you next week. Great.
Well, there's a lot to learn there. Sometimes as artists, we are tempted to say, well, listen, everybody does it this way. I'm going to do it another way. I'm going to do it a different way. And seeking originality is a wonderful thing. But there are certain things that we're just hardwired as human beings to physiologically and psychologically respond to. And using those like they did in this character design is really powerful. And if they had that attitude, well, I'm not going to have big eyes. All babies had big eyes. And I'm going to find another way to do it. They might have been able to pull it off. But this is just so powerful. It's a good reminder that sometimes there's no school like the old school.
Yeah. Well, and can I talk about another thing that The Mandalorian's doing well? Because I really am noticing it. By the way, at the point of recording this, in case these facts come up later on to be untrue, Brad and I have watched the first two episodes of Mandalorian. So I'm sure things might come out that are different later on. But I want to talk real quick about the immediate buy-in that The Mandalorian gets you that Rogue One got wrong in its first act, Star Wars Rogue One. Mm-hmm. The Mandalorian sets up the classic samurai or Wild West story of single gunslinger against a big bad world. That's all you need to know and go, right? That's all the buy-in. There's no massive setup. There's no world building. There's no, like, you got to remember these 10 key names. And that's where Rogue One went wrong. Everybody had to be named. Every ship had to be named. Every faction had to be named. Every planet was flashed on screen. And by the way, why did we have to flash through 10 planets in the act one of Rogue One? It was weird. Whereas it's another thing that Guardians of the Galaxy did right in one of their on-screen chyrons where they just go space. Like, okay, dumb shit. If you can't figure out where we are, we're in space. Like, that was great. I really appreciated that. Like, so the fact that The Mandalorian doesn't name the planets, doesn't name the characters, doesn't name the settlements, doesn't name either the lead character or the lead emperor guy I think you get one name so far of the scientist and you're in the story, which is great. It actually has made me reevaluate if I have been leaning too much towards world building and Drive, because frankly, where Star Wars started to go wrong is it was gearing too much towards, oh, we've got to build out this world for the 40-year-old nerds who are going to be on Wikipedia and checking all the data and facts, you know, and forgetting that, A, this is a story for children, and let's never forget that. This is a story for children. And also that you can overburden a story with too much BS if you load it up front. Let the story start from a simple place and build outward. Brad, what are your thoughts?
I think you're absolutely right. And the way you know that this was going to be better than that was that in every Star Wars movie and a lot of the series, it starts with this long scroll. Like, because right. That was so iconic from the first Star Wars movie, that long scroll. And of course, it was all these plot details that, like you said, you had to memorize. There was none of that. It just opens up with this really charming scene of him getting a bounty. And then Brian Posehn, of all people, driving
Brian Posehn, by the way, how excited were you for Brian that he got that part? Because you know he was so excited.
Oh, I was thrilled. I was thrilled. I'm like, I'm telling my kids, you know who that is? Immediately you hear that voice and it's like, oh, wow, this is great. Even though he got eaten immediately, it was still wonderful.
Oh, you know, Brian went home with a giant smile on his face that day. He's like, I got eaten. Hooray for me. You know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But they do so many things. And again, this idea of space opera as Western, not since Firefly have I gotten such a strong vibe that this is really going to be a satisfying narrative.
Yeah, exactly. It really speaks to how far off the prequels had gone when the initial scroll was like, because of a subset paragraph bounty that had been put on the Outer Limit planets from the banking clan, and then the Congress had voted for a third part, you know, and you're like, what's happening? Who cares?
Yeah.
And then The Mandalorian throws all that away and says, no, Star Wars is basically a Western. Just do a Western in space. That's what Star Wars is. And it speaks to how good a storyteller Jon Favreau is, that he wrote the first two episodes. You have to give him credit for any faults you might find with him. The fact that he brought to life the Marvel universe with that specific tone and quality and mix of realism and fantasy that they did so well. That's Favreau. Favreau did that. And he did these first two episodes. And you got to tip the hat to him because he nailed what the tone of Star Wars should be, especially following around a single character. It's really, really good.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting to see where this goes. I'm totally in.
Cut to week episode 6 when this podcast releases, and we now hate The Mandalorian because it went totally off the rails. And suddenly it's Jar Jar Binks and the banking clan back, and we're like, dang it, why did we record that podcast?
And we're on the show as subsequently saying, more like Mandaborian, am I right?
Well, I think though that tone, that's a lot of what Star Wars went wrong with. It started to try to please 40-year-olds too much.
Yeah.
That were too much in the weeds. And the basics, the need for an entertaining, simple, discreet story got forgotten in a lot of storytelling. Act 3 of Rogue One, delightful. Act 1 of Rogue One, a train wreck.
Yeah.
The prequels, a train wreck, story-wise. So The Mandalorian is really getting it right with a simple story done well. And anyway, that's a hats off to them for getting it right.
And a lot that we can all learn.
Absolutely. Boy,
yeah.
It really is a masterclass in following a single character. And also, Brad, not to use some weird phrasing on everybody, but it's a perfect buildings roman because his Beskar steel, his outer, literally his shell, is being added to his uniform as he builds up his own personality. As he, you know, buildings roman as a story is about someone coming of age, someone becoming who they're going to be. And The Mandalorian is the perfect metaphor for how that should be done, with the outer symbols mirroring the inner symbols of the heart and the mind and the emotions. So anyway, it's great. I can't say enough good things about that show. I'm really proud of how it's coming out for those folks. And on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show apparently about nerding out about Star Wars.
And nerding out about making a living about comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So, Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. So I've got a first question for you, Brad. We're going to jump right in. And this comes in from our friend Ace Connell over at patreon.com/comiclab. And he says, Dave and Brad, let's get hypothetical and say you wanted to launch a comic from scratch to build an audience quickly and had a crazy number, like 10 grand to spend to get there via ads or whatever medium, and you wanted to create a sustainable living from the results. How would you spend that $10,000, Brad Geiger? Assume in this hypothetical world that the comic is great. It's a great comic. It's just a marketing exercise. Thanks and love the show. All right. So, Brad, Ace's question. Oh. You have $10,000 theoretical dollars. What do you spend it on to build that comic?
Ace, you are a sneaky, sneaky devil, because here's the deal. We've said on the show, basically, you and I, we really don't. It's not that we don't believe in advertising so much as neither one of us has put any money behind advertising, foremost because social media is so effective and completely free, but also because to really do advertising well, you can't. It's not a do-it-yourself sort of thing. You've got to bring them. You really do have to bring a marketing department in. You've got to bring people in who know how to generate the message, how to craft the message, where to put the message, how to put it, when to put it. There's a lot of things that I am a do-it-yourselfer when it comes to publishing, and I revel in the DIY aspect of publishing. This is one thing that it just is not a good fit. And what Ace is doing in this hypothetical is he's trying to take that away. It's like, well, what if the money was no object? What would you do then? And I am going to dig my heels in and disappoint Ace, and I tell him I'd put that money in the bank. I'll tell you why. Because $10,000 is still a finite amount of money, no matter how, and you could say $100,000, any number you can throw at me is still a finite amount of money. And, I don't know that that I would be able, even if by the time you pay off all the people that you've got to pay off to make this thing happen, I don't know that it would be worth it to do. Am I wrong?
No, I my initial response to this when I read this question earlier was, huh, you got $10,000. Well, you're doing better than most people in webcomics for the first 5 years. Good job, Ace. Yeah. Way to hold on to that $10,000 because you just did better. I mean, really, okay, so looking at it seriously, the first 5 to 10 years, let's say 10 years of comic making online are a growing period. And I'm not joking when I say that you might be doing better than most people online.
Yes.
When you make the whole, just by holding on to that $10,000 versus all the folks that are working those 5-10 years to get to a livable, sustainable income. But let's do it, Brad, in kind of a Brewster's Millions kind of way. Does anybody remember the movie Brewster's Millions, where you have to spend the $10,000? So, okay, let me give my real answer first, Ace, is if I was going to say, if someone came to me and be like, listen, I made a lot of money in tech. I've got a couple million socked away. I'm now quitting my job at Google or Sun Microsystems or whatever it is, and I'm going to go into comics. Where would I spend 10 grand, right? And I'd first of all, I'd be like, don't waste that money. Don't just create a good comic, share it on social media, and let the market decide, right? That's the best way to do it. But if someone in a Brewster's Million fashion came to me with a gun to their head and said, I got to spend this 10 grand or it goes poof away, I've got to spend it. The way I personally would spend it would be not to use bigger ad networks. Definitely don't use Facebook. That thing, I trust it as much as I can throw it. I wouldn't use Facebook. I wouldn't use Instagram's platform. What I would do is approach individual cartoonists and say, hey, if you are willing to advertise this on your story, at some are, like our friend Chris Hallbeck does that occasionally, where they say, hey, I would like to make use of your 400,000 followers on Instagram, and the final panel of your comic can be an advertisement. You know, like a fifth panel, a sixth panel of your comic can be an advertisement. Or in your story, you'll do, Chris will do 10 of Chris's stuff and then one of a paid advertisement, right? What's nice about that is you can actually seek out audiences and comics that have a similar tone and tenor to yours. So it's not just a shotgun in the wind. It's more of a targeted, these people have a similar sense of humor or a similar story approach to the way I do comics.
Yeah.
Therefore, a percentage of that audience might like this. So anyway, I would suggest more targeted advertising through cartoonists, either on Instagram or Twitter, or maybe even on their own site. In that respect, Project Wonderful was great in its heyday. It's no longer here, but Brad, what would you do? How would you, in a Brewster's Millions kind of way, you have to spend the 10 grand or it goes away. It goes poof. Where do
I
you
can't
spend
wiggle out of it. Okay, so I'm going to take you through my thought process because here's the deal. Facebook, I agree. I wouldn't put $1 into Facebook, especially hearing that they were accused of gaming their numbers and everything. It's just a no-go for me. Instagram, I don't know. You had that whole conversation about I had 40,000 Instagram followers and it didn't really move the needle on Kickstarter. Since there is such limited opportunities for linking and for viral output on Instagram, I don't know that I would spend any money trying to build anything on Instagram. Instagram has us bamboozled into believing that link in bio is adequate promotion.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And it's not. It's not. So I don't know that I personally, with my personal experience, now I can see somebody like we mentioned, Chris Halbeck, who's tearing it up on Instagram. He's going to have different ideas on how that works. And he would probably be the first to say, well, no, maybe not. But if you're talking to Brad, I'm telling you, I don't see it. Now, Twitter, that has a maybe on it, but I don't know. It might be me being grumpy. When I see an ad or a promoted tweet, when I see a promoted tweet like more than two or three times on my timeline, I block them so I don't have to see it again. It's like, this is annoying as hell. I'm blocking this. Unless it's somebody that I might want to interface with in the future. But if it's like, T. Rowe Price or something, it's like, screw you. I'm blocking you so I don't have to see this again. You know, that
right.
Sprint
just
guy.
To get some variety in your advertising. Yeah.
You know, that guy with the long black hair for the phone company. It's got the magenta. Is that Sprint or the other one? T-Mobile? I don't know. I blocked him because I was getting really tired of seeing his face over and over again.
Right.
So I don't. I don't think that is a large thing. So I would avoid doing mirror research and do a little bit of market research. Twitter might get a little bit of my money. And then outside of that, okay, banner advertising, forget about it. It's worthless. It's number one, it's getting blocked. And number two, people are blind to it at this point. So banner advertising on websites is out. Now that leaves you with what we would call traditional media, TV, movies, print advertising, none of which I think are going to be effective for my comic. So what it comes down to is I might spend a little bit on Twitter advertising. Aside from that, I honestly don't know. You might have to put the bullet in my head. I don't know where I would spend that money.
I don't
believe in Facebook. Instagram, I'm not a believer. Twitter, I might put a little bit behind it. And then after that, the rest of the internet is a wipeout. As far as I'm concerned, as far as banner advertising. And then the rest of the advertising opportunities, I don't know.
I like how you went up and down. I don't know.
I'm getting nervous. I got this gun against my head.
Well, that's why I say I would not place $1 with any platform. I wouldn't do any Twitter promoted tweet bullshit, Instagram promoted story bullshit, Facebook promoted, none of those work, right? And the simple truth is, and I have friends in advertising, and I don't mind saying it, I think the vast majority of the modern media consumer, we have all collectively learned how to block out 99.99% of commercials. You can see them even on a basic level if you're reading, when they scroll up, when you're reading the New York Times, or when you're on Instagram, or when you're on a TV, you know instantly when to start mentally tuning out. And so I think one of the reasons why influencers and podcasts and smaller, more personal advertising is increasingly getting bigger and bigger ad buys is because the personal touch is harder for us to screen out mentally and emotionally. And so advertisers are finding that more effective. So what I would recommend, and I'm going to stick to this, is approaching cartoonists that are of similar like to you and saying, hey, if I gave you $500, would you be willing to mention, if you're comfortable with my, and you end up liking my comic, mention it in your blog or mention it on your Instagram story or mention it here. And by all means, say it's a promoted thing. I'm happy with that. You're happy with that. But only if you like it, you know? And what's nice about that is that the audience members then know, like, well, Brad talked about it. He said, I wouldn't have taken this as an advertisement if I didn't like the comic, that kind of thing.
Right. The only thing I would add to that, other than the fact that I remain on the fence on Instagram, let's say I'm buying into that. The only thing I would say to you is, why draw the line at comics? Why wouldn't you also approach maybe like a sci-fi author or a sci-fi cosplayer, better yet? Oh, in other words, why stop at comics? Why wouldn't you go broader? Because your audience is not necessarily sci-fi comics; they're more sci-fi enthusiasts, and you know what I'm saying? I would cast that net broader, don't you think?
Yeah, and again, I would go back to a point that Brad often repeats about messaging and marketing, which is. Yeah. That unless something is truly novel, like a product that you're like, what the heck is this? Like when the shake weight came out and everyone was like, what is this thing? unless there's something that on first glance makes everybody stand up and notice, most products, to Brad's much repeated point, have to be repeated 7, 8, 9, 10 times to really get into your mind space, right? Gosh darn it, I use the word mind space. I hate myself right now. And so unless you have a big advertising spend and it can hit the same person 7, 8, 9 times, you're going to get lost in the shuffle anyway, which is another reason why I think advertising expenditures are a waste of time. Because the reason why Coke's advertising works is because they're in front of every movie. They're at every sports game. They're in front of every NASCAR race. And so you're like, Coke. Okay, I see Coke. I see Coke. I see Coke. Yeah. And it slowly, subliminally gets into your mind. And then you go, oh, no, wait, it destroys teeth overnight.
Yeah, and they've locked down every fast food restaurant, so every time you have a choice, it's going to be a Coke product.
Right.
You know, there's a lot that has to do with conversations of late stage capitalism that go into this too. They've got the lockdown on every time you turn around, you're basically exposed to one of their products.
Right. And the same is true with Nike at any sports event. The same is true with Disney at any family event. Yeah. There's a certain amount of saturation that is necessary to get any impact because all of us are really effective at blocking out an advertising. In a way, like imagine someone, Brad, in the 1930s or 40s. I honestly would think way more susceptible to a shitty ad.
Yeah.
And by shitty, I mean not even well crafted than someone now, you know, who's like, nope, that's an ad, tuning out. Nah, nah, nah. And we all kind of go to our mental happy spaces until the YouTube ad finishes or else we mute, you know, whatever we do.
We're really good at not only ad blindness, but voluntary ad blindness where we just crop it out.
Yeah, quite literally crop it out. Your mind literally focuses in. So I think this is 10,000 poorly spent. I think Brad would say that's 10,000 poorly spent. Yeah. Let's talk about what does work. What does work is continuously producing good work that is shared. And that's the dirty little secret is that if it's not being shared, it's not as good as you think it is. And that's true for me as well. Look, I've had comics where I'm like, this one's gold. Oh, I love it. Oh, but I can't wait to share this one. I'm tweeting it. I'm putting it on Instagram and no one likes it. All right. Well, tomorrow crickets. I start again. You know, that kind of thing.
And I've got one more thought on that. As long as we're going down that road, Dave, one more caveat on that question. This is a launch of a brand new comic. And I would say that is even he says, you know, in this hypothetical, it's a great comic. I still wouldn't spend $10,000 on advertising a brand new comic. This is not Hollywood where we were talking, you know, about those releases where if people don't like the podcast release where people don't subscribe to in huge numbers in the first 3 weeks that they just drop the podcast. This isn't that. I don't think I would ever want to advertise, no matter how good it was, I wouldn't want to advertise a brand new comic. I would let that comic go out there for a few months, maybe a year, let it get its legs, let it get a little bit of audience. Then we could maybe talk about advertising if it was a gun to the head situation. We could talk about advertising because then once you bring people into that product, into that feature, if it does take with them, then they've got a whole bunch of archive to read, and you can cement that fandom as opposed to a brand new comic where you're going to bring them in. You've got maybe three pages up. Okay, maybe you've got them kind of interested, but they're not going to be maybe super emotionally invested after three pages. And if they wander away and don't come back, that's wasted ad dollars. So I would wait until that comic matures a little bit and then put some money into it. Mature it. Let it mature.
Let that thing mature, everybody. Hey, everybody, mature it. You got to mature that thing. I love the way you say mature. Is your child young or is them mature? Oh, all right. Well, they went to school then. All right, fantastic. They is mature. I love suddenly become like an Appalachian ding, 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 ding. Well, you is mature. Anyway, so, okay, I do, since you had raised Chris Houellebecq before, because I want this to be a forum for what I think is good ideas, I want to admit that our potential failure with describing Instagram as a bit of a huckster play on Facebook's part.
Yeah.
Chris had a great counterpoint, and I want to bring it onto the show because I think it is a good idea and possibly true. Brad had said, is it possible that 100,000 Instagram followers are not as valuable as 10,000 Twitter followers? And both Brad and I nodded sagely and went, yeah, that might be true. And Chris made a great counterargument that I think both Brad and I will allow as a smart idea. He said, maybe it's the case that 100,000 Instagram followers that you've gained in the last 6 months are not as effective as 9,000 Instagram or Twitter followers that you've had for the last 5 to 10 years. And both Brad and I went, nah, there's truth to that. Yep. There is truth to that. Because a lot of it is about the emotional expenditure that they've made over years into who Brad Geiger is. Not just that they like Brad Geiger, but it's been an investment of 5 to 10 years that Brad's been in their life. So that's why I think that's worth bringing onto the show as a good counterpoint to what we were saying, because I think Chris might have some truth to that. So that's that.
Absolutely. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics.
So Brad, once again, today's Comic Lab is being brought to you by the good folks at Wacom over at WACOM.com. Wacom, as you know, is the maker of Cintiqs and Intuos and all the fantastic drawing products. And both Brad and I use them. And Brad, I have been using a Wacom for over 10 years now.
Wow.
And for the first time ever, I was over at the Culver City Mall in Los Angeles, and they had one of those Microsoft stores, and I tried a Surface.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to tell you, one of the things that Wacom did right in designing their pen, and where I think Microsoft, frankly, did wrong, is that not only is their pen too thin, which is a weird drawing experience, but there's only one button on it. And when you think about it, there's 4 points of activation on a Wacom pen. It's got both the drawing surface, the eraser end, which can be used for a wide variety of things. It doesn't have to be an eraser. It could be this side is brush, this side is airbrush kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And then it's got the rocker button on the top, on the where your fingers would hold. That is super helpful for being able to go from pen to eraser or this or that. Very quick switch ups. Some people set it for brush size, so you can very quickly size up, very quickly size down, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. And I think that's one of the better design iteration choices that Wacom made with designing those things, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I love my Wacom pen. And I also think it fits my hand perfectly. Like when I first looked at it, I'm like, oh, that's pretty big. That's a chunky unit, you know, for a pen. I don't know about that. And then all of a sudden I started using it and it's like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. It's a much more relaxed. In other words, I see that Surface Pen and I feel you'd have to clench your hand around it. It's super skinny and it's going to engender a certain amount of hand cramps. Whereas that Wacom pen is just ergonomically kind of delightful.
Yeah. It's one of those things, like, remember when you were in grade school and you would either hold a pencil, but you would also maybe go to the drugstore and buy one of those 20-cent rubber, expander things that would make your fingers fit the pencil better. I feel like Wacom did a good job on this. And it's a small thing, but it shows, like, how it is designed specifically for art, whereas the Surface was designed for 1,000 uses. Where the Wacom is like, no, you're going to have a comfortable drawing hand while you draw. And I think that's a sign towards why that thing works so well. Anyway, I'm really happy to have them the rest of the 2019 as sponsors, and you can go check them out at wacom.com. And Bradley J. Geiger, what is our next topic, my friend?
Oh, we've got a topic that I'm fascinated by. As soon as this entered in over the transom, I said, we have got to talk about that.
Okay.
So here it is. This comes from our friend and Patreon backer, Jay. And Jay says, I'm working on the second draft of a 22-page comic script, and I'm having a hard time with the rewrite. Scenes are moving around or just getting removed altogether. Do you have any tips on how to rework story the second or third or fourth or fifth time around? He's struggling with the rewrite, Dave. What advice do you have for him?
This is a great question. So there's a couple different ways to do this on software. But I'm going to assume that you're still at the script stage. So maybe you've done some thumbnailing. Maybe it's been a couple of quick sketches of this or that page. But I'm going to assume that you haven't actually drawn any of the pages yet, because it sounds to me like you're still working on the story. So I first and foremost, I'm going to suggest the tried and true index card method, which is that you have differently colored index cards, perhaps, where blue means story, red means character emotional arcs, yellow means, point of action or whatever.
Yeah.
Or you could just use all white cards. And what you do is a lot of writers, screenwriters do this. You literally have a giant pin board or a wall in your house where you just, or even your floor, frankly. I've seen writers do this too, where you move around the cards and be like, if this point of action happens before this revelation, how does that change the story? And then you kind of glance at the floor or at the wall and you go, oh, I see, that would move my story around.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about creating discrete individual units of your story chunks is that they're very easy to move around, right? Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of software programs that do that for you that say, okay, the traditional index card method that writers use for 100 years, now we have it digitally, so you can literally drag and drop index cards around this digital pin board. That's also very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would suggest both of those if you are on the rewrite, the second or third or fourth rewrite. It's a nice way to make the individual chunks discrete and individual so that you can move them around. Brad, what's your thought?
I love that process. I love that idea. And I would say do it on index cards myself, just because it's more tactile. And I really do believe in the same way that we know through science that we remember things better when we physically write it down as opposed to typing it or anything else. I think there's something to be said for that tactile experience of moving stories.
Yeah.
And also, you're not going to, like, if there's a story point or a plot point that you're taking out and you move it to the side, you're not going to lose it. You know, it's going to be sitting there, you know, somewhere either on the floor or on the side of the pasteboard there. And, you know, you're not going to lose track of it quite so easily. And you never know when something like that is going to be just the thing to bring it back in. So I'm going to say, yes, Dave's got the exact right idea here for helping to organize your thoughts. And I'm also going to say this, Jay. You're on your second or third rewrite, and it's confusing, and things don't seem to be hanging together, and you know something's missing, and you're frustrated, and you feel like there's no way out. And I want you to know that what's happening to you is a process that we call writing. You are doing.
I was wondering where you were going
writing.
With that.
And
you stinker.
No. Congratulations. I'm not putting him down. Congratulations. You're doing it fantastic. The fact that you're on the second or third rewrite makes my heart sing. I'm absolutely thrilled because there's a lot of people that think that they can just crap this stuff out. They're going to do it one time through, maybe check it for spelling, and then they're putting that sucker out into the world. You are really taking some time to think about what you're doing. You are doing, I know it's painful. I know it's frustrating. I know it's infuriating and maddening.
What?
Infuriating. Maddening. What? You have a problem with maddening?
I'm just going to go quiet at this point. You're doing great. Keep going.
You're absolutely frustrated. And yes. That tells you that you're doing writing right. If you're ready to pull your freaking hair out by the roots, congratulations, you're a writer. Welcome to the club. It hurts. And the extent to which that you're experiencing frustration makes my heart beat with glee, because I know what you finally do come up with is going to be worth reading. So get back in there. Don't give up. And don't let yourself off the hook or settle for second best. You get in there right. With your index cards and you shift them around until that story makes sense to you. Congratulations. You're doing better than 90%. I've no exaggeration. 90% of the people who are out there doing webcomics, you're doing better than them already because you're feeling the pain. A part of the creative process. Welcome to it. It stinks, but it gets better.
Well, and I will recommend something, a different technique too from index cards, which is, first of all, I completely co-sign with Brad. Congratulations, you are in the process and you're doing it right.
Yeah.
But I will say this, that sometimes when I have been fiddling with a story too much, like I've moved around too many chunks and I've forgotten where things are going, like what, did I move this part? I don't remember if I moved that part. Is that character carrying the book now? I don't remember. I got to go back and look. If you've rewritten something 3, 4, 5 times and you're finding that you yourself are confused, mm-hmm. One thing that I would recommend is putting that aside, giving yourself a beat, and then, frankly, rewriting fresh. And what I mean by that is you now, with 4 rewrites done, 5 rewrites done, you have internalized and synthesized a lot of the changes in your heart, right? Your mind knows what it wants to do now. So now, maybe if you're feeling confused with the main story, maybe try breaking it out fresh, whether it's in fresh index cards, a fresh story outline, a fresh flow. Sometimes after too many rewrites, it actually benefits to start fresh and go, okay, so now I'm going to do this. Right. Okay. Yes. And then they're going to say that. Right. Okay, good. And then we're going to go to this location. Uh-huh. Okay, good.
Yep.
And you will sometimes find, and this is only after a few rewrites, you'll sometimes find that coming at it fresh, both A, adds new and fresh details to it, but B, helps you better synthesize, now that you've done it a couple of times in rewrites, where you wanted to go, where you netted out, and you'll find that the flow is better. It's like, because now you're approaching it with the rewrite that you are literally doing right now, not something that you might have done weeks ago, not something that you moved around 4 times. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, I know that this character has not yet walked into this room, so I now put it in the new outline.
Right.
Brad, do you ever take a fresh stab at it when you've had a few rewrites that feel like they're stalling or getting confusing?
Absolutely. And you know what helps when you say start fresh is that one thing that I really rely on a lot is change the point of view. In other words, if I've been telling the story from the point of view of person A, I'm going to change it up and present that story from the point of view of person B and see, okay, now how is person B experiencing this? Or if I've got an omniscient third party, I'm going to make it a first person story, you know, and change that up. A lot of times changing just the point of view, seeing that scene from a different angle is going to open that right up for you.
Right. And then one final thing that I would add into this, and we've said this before, but if your deadlines are forgiving, mm-hmm. you can also let time be your editor.
Yes.
And so give yourself a couple of days, give yourself a week, step away from it. Come back at it, and as you reread the notes or reread the outline or reread the index cards, you'll go, oh, wait, this part is, no, I did this wrong. I got to move this part.
Yeah.
And you'll see it immediately in a way that you didn't when you were in the weeds of it mentally. So take a break, take a step back, give yourself whatever time your deadline will allow for, and then let a fresh version of you come in a few days later and have a new read of it. Brad?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So Dave, I've got another question from one of our $5 Patreon backers that I think you're going to be absolutely fascinated with. You want to hear this one?
Let's do it. Yes.
So this one's coming in from our Patreon backer, Mike, and he says, hey guys, longtime listener, first time caller, writer, question asker. Nope, can't do it. First time inquirer.
There we go.
I love the show and was even a fan of Webcomics Weekly back in the day. By the way, is there a place to find all those old episodes?
The answer is good question.
Yeah, the answer is yes. Webcomics.com has the complete library, and they're available without a subscription. They're public to anybody that wants them. Just go over to webcomics.com and scroll down, and you'll see the link.
And since Brad is too humble to mention it, I'm going to pitch it real quick. Webcomics.com, Brad's incredible resource for creating and making a living with webcomics. I would go check it out and have a look. I heartily endorse webcomics.com, Brad's longstanding project of great worth over at webcomics.com.
Ah, thank you. That's very kind of you. You know, in this January, it's going to be 10 years.
No, really?
Yes. Yes, I launched it.
Oh, my God, Brad.
In January 2010. January 1st.
My first thought, honest to God, was, wow. My second thought was, we're so old. That was my second thought.
No, we've got a lot of 10 and 20 year anniversaries these days. It's feeling a little weird.
Bring me my cane. Oh, God. All right, keep going.
So here's Mike's question. I'm not a cartoonist. I'm a writer. So my question focuses on that part of the creative process. I have found that I often lean too hard to one side or the other of the drama-humor equation, and I feel that the best stories find a balance of both. You have both done storylines that have had good balance. How do you find that balance without having it become slapstick or Hamlet and still get across a great story? Thanks again for all the years of creative advice. I have recommended you guys to many people as the cartoonist version of Click and Clack.
Well, before we answer this question, I want to say with thanks, I love the fact that Michael is a writer and comes to the show, because we've had more than a few artists. We've had like a Brad. Remember, we had a sculptor.
Yep.
We had someone who works in what do you call it? Not needlework. What's the other one?
Embroidery. Anyway, we had a jewelry maker.
Embroidery. Yeah, where she said basically 90% of what you talk about is applicable to what I do. And we were like, hey, that's great. Because really it comes down to you are a person that wants to create and share what you have created with the world and ideally make some money on it. And that really is the core aspect of what Comic Lab is. So I'm really happy, Michael, that as a writer, you found value in the podcast. So thank you for that. And then also to your question about balancing the drama with the comedy. Well, let's talk about, frankly, what both are. Both are building up pressure and releasing them, right? We've said that on the show. Both tragedy is building up pressure and then releasing it in a cathartic and sad way. Like, we are all in this together. We all have terrible moments.
Yeah.
Look what this character is going through, and you have that too. Comedy is... oh, look at this. Oh, we all see it going wrong. We're going wrong, and it's gone wrong. How hilarious. Oh, that's fun, right?
Yeah.
But also remember what Mel Brooks said, that tragedy is when I stub my toe. Comedy is when you fall into a pit and die. And so so both of them are versions of the same thing about what we universalize and what we personalize.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, frankly, the Greeks had it better in how they intermix both. Whereas now... there frankly is a marketing push, and I do think it is a marketing thing, where a book is sold as a comedy, a book is sold as a tragedy. Whereas, Brad, your life today is not going to be a tragedy. It's not going to be a comedy. It's going to be a mix of both. You're going to laugh at some points. You're going to open a letter and be sad at some points. you're going to look at your children and giggle together about something, and that'll be a moment of comedy, right? What I'm getting at is life is a balance. So really, an ideal story balances both of those. So now the question is, how, Brad? How do you balance tragedy with drama, with comedy in your story?
Well, for me, it's a matter of pragmatism and practicality. In other words, I build it in as part of an overall publishing system. Okay, so I'm doing a graphic novel and I'm releasing it on the web in half page updates. And I've talked about on the show in the past how I do that. But basically, what's appearing on my website every day is a half a page at a time. Now, along with my longstanding philosophy that every comic has got to be built with the idea that somebody's coming to your comic for the first time ever today.
Right.
And what they find on that website has to grab them. That's a really like one of my number one strong cardinal beliefs. The comic that I've got up on my website today has to grab the first time visitor today. Not the archives, not anything else, not a sentence at the bottom of the site that explains what's going on. None of that. It's got to be the comic. And the best way to do that is with a lighthearted moment, a punchline, something funny happening at the end of that half page.
Right.
So right. I build, and if not that, a moment of big excitement or a cliffhanger, there's other things other than a punchline that I can put that. In that spot, nothing quite as effective as a punchline, but there are other things like a cliffhanger works very well, or a big a surprise
massive punch
moment,
or a big explosion.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But the punchline works best. So my approach to balancing drama and humor in my comic comes from nothing more than a practical application of I want every half page to be. A grabber for that first timer. And I know I can do that with a punchline. Plus, when I put those together into the book and I read it, there's always a couple of interesting moments. There's a couple of interesting story beats on every page because every half page, I'm hitting something significant. If it's not a punchline, it's a moment, it's a beat, it's something. And when you put that all together, it builds up a really nice rhythm as you're reading. So I find my balance through nothing more than practicality. I want there to be something, an interesting story beat. 9 chances out of 10, it's a punchline every half page. And I build out my stories that way. The story right. arcs can be very dramatic. The story arcs that's going on in Evil Inc. right now over the past, 6 to 8 months are very, very dramatic. But they're told in moments that often have little moments of uplift to them. There's something serious going on over top, but I've got a little something every half page there that's giving you something meaningful to hold on to. It's practicality, Dave. I know you put together Drive in a different way. How do you try to balance those moments?
Well, since we're talking page by page format, yes,
yeah.
I like Brad, having a satisfying ending on every page and whatever satisfying means to you in that moment of the story, it's got to have some build up, either a punchline, a release, a tragic turn, a story point that's major, a large explosion, something that's happening that's a big end to that page, right? So a version of get them to turn them to the next page. That's
yes.
what you're trying to achieve. And you can recontextualize that for a chapter book, for a novel. You can think about how you make every chapter have a satisfying advancement of the storyline, but also a satisfying advancement of the comedy amongst tragedy or the mm-hmm. reactions that are reacting to the terrible moments, right? And so another way to look at it, this separate from satisfying moments page by page, is to look at what kind of story structure you would like to go through. So with Drive, my structure for that story is a serious story. The story is essentially a tragedy. It's about greed. It's about war. It's about character. It's about deprivation on an imperial scale.
Mm-hmm.
But populating that story are, frankly, goofy characters. Characters
right.
that kind of shouldn't exist in that universe. They are they are reacting in big and fun and loving ways towards and doing their best amongst tragic circumstances. Right.
Yeah.
Now, I think you could argue that the reverse of that is also a possible way to structure a story. So, for example, BoJack Horseman, serious characters for the most part in comedic situations.
Yeah.
So BoJack is sad as hell. Like, that character is depression 101. And And yet the show finds laughter because the situations are ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. I think you could also say the same for Rick and Morty. I think actually those are serious characters in incredibly ridiculous over-the-top situations. But like that show is about a son that doesn't love or, you know, children that aren't loved by their parents, parents that are in the middle of a divorce, a grandfather that's absentee and frankly a little bit not great for his daughter, a daughter that's not great for her father. Mm-hmm. They're all characters that are terrible for each other, but they're in these ridiculous genre-bending situations, and it comes across as funny. So anyway, that's just quick, my 10-cent versions on stories. But mm-hmm. I think that combining serious story, goofy characters, or goofy story, serious characters is a great way to look at a story creation, because I think that's helpful, at least, as you first start to craft it. And then I had another point that I totally forgot about. So here's where I kind of go over to Brad and say, Brad, what other thoughts do you have? While I try desperately to remember what my second point was.
Well, you try to vamp that up. Well, listen, the other part, too, is you have to approach storytelling the same way you approach maybe something like cooking, knowing full well that your ability to make a good dish is your ability to judge the seasonings. And to go back and say, okay, am I getting too funny here? Am I getting too serious? And there's always a way to kind of adjust for that and to put a light moment in to a serious moment and to an overall serious arc. And as a matter of fact, those light moments are super powerful when tensions get really, really super built up. Think of that first Avengers movie when Coulson gets killed by Loki. And then later on, shoots Loki from off camera with this huge gun. And this camera whirls around to Coulson, who's in the midst of dying, or so we're expected to believe. And he says, oh, that's what that's for. You know, and he got the biggest laugh of the movie because the tension had built up so strongly that the comedy was just an amazing release of that tension. You can use comedy and drama in the same scene to do the same sorts of things. So you can go through and season that up. If you feel like you're saying, oh, sometimes I bury the needle on one side or the other, you can go back as we're talking to Jay about the rewrite. You can go back and do a rewrite and find some moments to insert a little levity into your drama and use drama as a way to help build that tension to your next funny moment, and which is going to make it even funnier. Dave, did I vamp long enough for you?
You did. And what I wanted to remember was the TV writing term of treacle cutter. Brad, have you ever heard the term treacle cutter?
No, I've never heard that.
So it's in let's say it's a family show, and they're having their very serious episode. You know what I'm talking about? The issues episode.
Very special episode.
Yeah, little Jimmy had a friend that died, or Susie lost her dog, or whatever it is, right? And so the very special episode will be sad, but then what they'll insert is what's called a treacle cutter. And treacle is that ultra super syrupy, sugary thing that you use to cook. Yeah. But in TV writing, treacle is very often looked down upon because it's an overly sweet moment that cuts the tragedy with a little bit of laughter, right?
Yeah.
And so you actually do, as much as I set that up as though it's disparaging, you actually do want treacle cutters amid tragedy, because one of the reasons why people laugh at a funeral sometimes, mm-hmm. and remembering what Brad Geiger was like, well, I don't know why I'm making it Brad Geiger out. That's funny.
Wait a minute, I'm still here.
No. For the intents and purposes, you're dead here.
Oh,
so
okay.
We're at Brad's funeral, and like I've had 3 solid hours of crying, but then someone goes, remember the way Brad always used to be caught with a second knuckle up his finger or up his nose, and everyone would laugh, and we'd be like, no, that's true. Brad always did have a second knuckle up his nose. And we'd laugh because you need, the heart needs a break. You know, you can't be sad forever. And so you need, as a point both of healing and a point of saying life goes on, TV writing inserts these treacle cutters to cut the moment. And so you don't want to have pages and pages of this, because a tragedy still requires actions and motivations that are commensurate with what's happening in the story. But you do have to allow your characters a moment of levity, because they are living creatures who will require a break. You know, everybody needs a break. And even in a funeral, in the context of a funeral, you have to laugh every couple of hours, because Your heart just needs it. So balance that out. And then also, if you have a strongly comedic story, you do have to balance it out with tragedy because, quote unquote, something has to happen. You can't right. just be laughing your way through life or else it becomes a Disney-esque story. You have to have some serious actions and results of those actions. And that's where the tragedy comes mm-hmm. Brad, did we cover that one solidly? Is there anything else we need to add to that?
Well, yeah. I think the overlying arc is that comedy and tragedy are both have the exact same mechanics. You know, it's the same thing. And you can interchange them a little bit more freely if you actually maybe stop thinking about them as two different things, but as two sides of the exact same coin.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're both weapons in your, that's not the right tool. They're both tools in your tool shed. They're both tools in your tool shed. And if you balance them out correctly, you will get your readers, you'll take them on a journey that's both satisfying for them to see the characters going through and one that informs their own existence. And that's really what you want your art to do, but to be both entertaining and something that edifies and teaches them about how to go through life. And so, characters that in a healthy way journey both through tragedy and comedy are edifying in how we should go through life. And so that's why truly great art teaches along with entertains. So
absolutely.
Anyway, let me go on to our next and final question for the show, Brad. And this comes in from Cole Chadwick. And Cole says, "Hey, Brad and Dave, I have a two-part question for you. Since it's clearer now than ever before that comics readership is not tied to any specific genre, character, or art style, I've been asking myself, why do people read comics to begin with? I've read Scott McCloud and Will Eisner's takes on the subject, and I have some ideas of my own, but I would like to hear your guys' thoughts. So here are my questions. Question one, what do comics do better than any storytelling medium? And what are some ways creators can lean into those strengths so they can make comics better?" Brad, which one would you like to tackle first there? What do comics do better or which?
Well, I'll start
with... That was a very Jabba the Hutt laugh, by the way.
Jabba the Wookie. All right, here we go.
I'll take number one first, and you're going to be disappointed.
All right, he's going to take number one for $500. All right, Brad's going for number one. Let's give him a shout out here. Brad Geiger going for question number one.
What do comics do better than any other medium? Nothing. I'm sorry to be a disappointment here, but comics have comics are a medium, and they don't have any advantage or disadvantage over any other medium. Film has the ability to combine images and words, but at the same time, a novel can evoke imagery just as well. They're all just different ways of telling stories, and you can tell a great story in a comic, or you can tell a great story in a series of pamphlets. If your story is good, it really doesn't matter. I'll tell you what makes comics, for me, better than any other medium, and it's the ability for one person to put their singular vision across without any other things getting in the way, without other people maybe muddying the waters or relying on another person or anything else like that. It's for me, the best way to have a visual storytelling experience that doesn't require other people. It can be a singular vision. That's what, for me, the strength of comics. But if you're going to tell me that comics have a strength over movies or TV or novels or any other, or video games or any other kind of medium, I'm not sure that I will agree with you. And by the way, I think that's perfectly okay. I don't think that comics need to be better than all the other mediums just because we're cartoonists. For me, it's more about the ability to have a singular vision that I can put out into the world. I know that's a disappointing answer, Dave. Where am I wrong?
How dare you say that comics are not a sweet, special snowflake, Brad Geiger? How dare you? Well, this has been the final Comic Lab as we learn that Brad hates comics.
Yeah, the next show, we're just going to have to call it Lab.
Well, yeah. Welcome back to Lab, because comics are useless and don't do anything, according to Brad Geiger. All right, no, so I take a very different attitude than Brad on this, and so this is Mommy and Daddy are going to fight on this one, so that's okay. Let's talk about active versus passive mediums. So comics are an active medium. The passive mediums you receive passively, television, movies, radio, music, you are receiving those passively. You're not a participant in the, let's say, receptive process of that art. Active mediums, reading, comics, video games that are first-person shooters that also have stories involved with them. Those you are actively participant. And so something about them triggers a little bit extra in your emotive ability because you are, your brain is a little bit internalizing what is happening with that story. It's sometimes in a way that's better, sometimes just different than a passive medium like movies and TV. Now, what do movies and TV do that comics and books and video games can't? Well, video games can do it. They also can incorporate music, which is an incredible trigger towards emotion, right? A movie and a TV, there's no argument. The lights, the sounds, the color quality of the way a thing is shot, the way the camera can lead you through a scene, incredibly emotional. So there's a reason why in the 20th century books have lost out to TV and movies, right? Also, because frankly, the imagination of a storyteller is often better in a movie than it is for a the average reader. So anyway, so now let's switch over to the passive mediums, books and comics. What do they do really well? As you read a story, and this is true even with comics, which is literally showing you what's happening, you are imagining what is happening. You are filling out the world. Even if it's just like if Iron Man says to somebody else in a scene, oh, well, Spider-Man is doing so-and-so, you are imagining what Spider-Man is doing in that moment off camera, right, in the comics. So you're doing that. But what's great about what comics, I think, do really well that even novels can't do is it gives you a better and more holistic vision of what is happening in a story. Like, for example, if a picture says 1,000 words, comics are even more effective at that because they're editorializing what you're seeing. So it's contextualizing an already strong image with the artist's and the writer's vision for what the story is doing. So I think that's a really effective combo, that marriage of writing and image. And I think comics have a great way of meeting the reader at the point that they can meet it. What I mean by that is when you are passively receiving a movie, no matter if you're ready for it or not, the next scene is coming. Whereas if you need to reread a page of X-Men, you can reread that page of X-Men. That's okay. Take your time. It's going to be there for you at the pace you can read it at and the pace you can understand it. So for a kid that's a new reader, for an adult that's a struggling reader, then no matter what pace you want to read Blankets at, you can read Blankets at your pace. So that's an effective strength. And I think what's truly great about comics that a novel can't do, and it's one of the most effective ways to tell a story, is you can show, not tell. A novel, no matter what's happening, even in non-dialogue moments, you're having to use words to describe a vision. Whereas in comics, you can literally just show what the moment is, even if that's pages and pages and pages of showing a character leaving work, getting in their car, going home. You can show it. You don't have to tell it.
Right.
And so I think comics do that really well. And I think what's also true is comics can do one thing that novels can't do, which is in the exact same moment, in the exact same panel, you can show the ironies and the inconsistencies of life. So a character can say, while they're talking on a phone, I'm very happy, but you see that they are actually sad in that moment. Whereas a novel takes a couple of sentences to communicate that. A comic can do it for you, bang, right away. You know, you're in. So those are some of the things that I think comics do really well. So unlike Brad, I will think that comics are a valuable medium and contribute to the world, even though Brad would like to throw them into the dustbin of history.
No, I never said that I didn't think comics were valuable. Okay, everything you said was perfectly reasonable and very right. I guess I just get a little bit worried about fetishizing what comics do to the point that we're kind of over romanticizing it. I would just as soon take a look at comics as a medium that has certain facets to it that I can use And I don't know that I spend a lot of time wondering whether one is better than the other. I think there are some comics that are better than some movies I've seen. And I think there are some movies that are better than some comics I've seen. And focusing on, if I'm going to do comics, I'm going to do the best comic I can, is much more important to me than worrying about whether comics are better than movies in general.
I agree. I'm not fighting you on that point. No, I think both Brad and I would agree that the best of any medium is a true accomplishment. It doesn't matter what you know. It doesn't matter if Godfather was a movie. It served its story best by being a movie. It didn't have to be a comic, and so and frankly wouldn't have worked as well as a comic. Yeah, I will agree with Brad that it's kind of like, we can argue over which one is better. But the truth is they all have their strengths. They all have their downsides. I will agree with Brad, because I didn't talk about it, that I think my favorite part about comics is that it can still be a singular storytelling by one person that somehow recreates what film and television require to be 100 people, 200 people working on a project. Mm-hmm. So Brad, as a single storyteller, can come kind of emotionally close to what a film or a TV show can do with 200 employees.
Right.
Not really. I mean, we all know that there's a very big difference between a TV show and what Brad or I could produce. But as far as communicating a story with all the bangs and zooms and camera angles and lighting and costume choices and set dressings and casting, Brad can do all of that for his story, and there's something sort of wonderful about that in a world of market-tested art where you can have a very singular, very distinctive story told by one person. Don't you think, Brad?
Yeah. Or even if not one person, a small team. For example, I would be remiss, it was me who brought up this idea of a singular vision, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention that when Alex Heberling colors my work, she adds an entire another layer of storytelling onto that vision. By what she's adding there, she can make a story emote 9 different ways depending on how she approaches her part of the process. So singular is accurate for a lot of comics, and also maybe we could also say a small team as well. But that same idea kind of comes through in that I can put this out with a whole lot fewer influences that I may or may not appreciate than I can in other media. And when it comes to the second part of that question, how do you lean into it? That's the part that I think is worth leaning into the most. In other words, I would say revel in your ability to create a singular or a small team based vision. That's the part that frankly, I find most exciting about comics is the part that I'm seeing something that is as pure as any other type of art that I can be consuming at the moment. This is really what this person or this small group of people are really intending for me to feel. And there's something that's really kind of wonderful about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So since we've established that Mommy and Daddy aren't really fighting about this, let's go on to the second part. How can we lean into the strengths of comics, whatever comparatively they are or are not? Any thoughts on that, Brad? What can you do as a cartoonist to lean? Wait, why are you laughing? What did I do wrong?
Because that's what I just got done saying.
Well, I mean, yeah, it is. All right. Well, then I guess I was giving you a chance to more directly address that, is that you were saying, lean into the minimized voices.
How do you lean in? I say you lean in by reveling in the singular nature of comics.
Gotcha. Okay.
What would you say would be the best place to lean in?
I would say that the unique interplay and dance of visuals and words is one of the truly unique things of comics.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say in your wording, in your writing, don't underplay the ability of the lettering itself. Both the font choices, the words, the placement, the energy of the lettering. Don't forget that in itself is a character in the comic. It's a mood on the page. So everything from your voice bubbles to your lettering to your font choice to your handwriting to whatever, your kerning, your letting, all of that influences the comic. So I think you're drawing words as well as writing pictures in a comic.
Mm-hmm.
And so try to make sure that both of them balance out.
Oh, absolutely. Especially the word balloons.
Yeah. And then also in your pictures, remember that comics can do what novels cannot, which is we can show, don't tell. So lean into that as a storytelling.
Yeah.
That a character doesn't have to say, I am sad. They can just be sad. And you can do it with all the subtlety that you're able to draw of allowing them to show while trying to look tough that they are sad, that kind of thing. And then remember that the dance of the words in the pictures is unique to comics. So let that be a point that can inform your writing rather than something that you fight against. But I think, frankly, 99% of what we talk about on Comic Lab is how do we lean into the strengths of comics. So I think we've probably put a button on that in a way that's inclusive of all 2 years of these Comic Lab podcasts. So,
Absolutely. And meanwhile, you have been leaning into Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been the ever-delightful friend Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my friend Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the sponsor for this week and the rest of 2019 are good friends over at Wacom at WACOM.com, Wacom.com. The Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
And this hour of comics advice is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we're going to go ahead and say that twice. Cut.
What happened?
I just lost my complete mind.
I'm gonna finish it off for you, Brad. It's a URL you're not familiar with. Patreon.com/comiclab. That's right, patreon.com/comiclab.
'm A mirror in your pocket, is that? Because I can see myself in your pants.
Oh, God. A, that's a terrible pickup line. And B, it's so disturbing to imagine Yoda making a move on anybody.
Buy you a drink, I will.
Oh, God.